Welcome. You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thanks for joining us for January 27th, Saturday reading of the Arapahoe County News. My name is Tim Elliott. Today I'll be reading the following main articles. Supreme Court is urged to rule Trump is ineligible to be president again because of the January 6th riot. By Mark Sherman, Associated Press. CCA Aurora Police Honor Community, Student Inclusion Leaders by Kristen O., Sentinel, Colorado. ADUs unfold as Centennial Eyes Land Banking by Taylor Shaw. Continued decline of stream flows projected for Colorado by Heather Sackett. Suspected Centennial Walmart carjacker arrested accused of attempted homicide by Taylor Shaw. Pedestrian bridge at Elate Street on Highline Canal Trail opens by Nina Joss. And I'll also be reading some various stories and articles. Supreme Court is urged to rule Trump is ineligible to be president again because of the January 6th riot. The Supreme Court should declare that Donald Trump is ineligible to be president again because he spearheaded the violent attack on the U.S. Capitol in an effort to overturn his 2020 election loss, lawyers leading the fight to keep him off the ballot told the justices on Friday. In a filing filled with vivid descriptions of the January 6, 2021 violence at the Capitol, the lawyers urged the justices not to flinch from doing their constitutional duty and to uphold a first-of-its-kind Colorado court decision to kick the 2024 Republican presidential frontrunner off the state's primary ballot. Nobody, not even a former president, is above the law, the lawyers wrote. The court will hear arguments in less than 2 weeks in a historic case that has the potential to disrupt the 2024 presidential election. The case presents the high court with its first look at a provision of the 14th Amendment barring some people who engaged in insurrection from holding public office. The amendment was adopted in 1868 following the Civil War. In their plea to the court, the lawyer said, Trump intentionally organized and incited a violent mob to attack the United States Capitol in a desperate effort to prevent the counting of electoral votes cast against him after he lost the election to Democrat Joe Biden. They call for a decision that makes clear that what happened on January 6th was an insurrection, for which Trump bears responsibility. The president is covered by the constitutional provision at issue, and Congress doesn't need to take action before states can apply it, the lawyers wrote. The written filing includes extensive details of Trump's actions leading up to January 6th, including his tweet on December 19, 2020, in which he informed his followers of a planned protest on the day Congress would count the electoral votes, and wrote, "Be there. We'll be wild." Then, in his speech to supporters on January 6th, the lawyers wrote, Trump lit the fuse. The brief reproduces photographs of the mayhem from that day, including one of U.S. Capitol Police officer Daniel Hodges pinned in a doorway during the attack. Trump's lawyers have argued that efforts to keep him off the ballot threaten to disenfranchise tens of millions of Americans and promise to unleash chaos and bedlam if other states follow Colorado's lead. The Colorado Supreme Court's 4-3 ruling should be reversed for any of several reasons, Trump's lawyers wrote, including that Trump did not engage in insurrection and that the presidency is not covered by the amendment. They also contend that Congress would have to enact legislation before states could invoke the provision to keep candidates off the ballot. The justices are hearing arguments February 8th. Trump already has won the first two GOP presidential contests, the Iowa caucuses and the New Hampshire primary. Former UN Ambassador Nikki Haley is Trump's sole remaining significant GOP opponent. Still, both sides have said the court needs to act quickly so that voters know whether Trump is eligible to hold the presidency. The court is dealing with the dispute under a compressed time frame that could produce a decision before Super Tuesday on March 5th, when the largest number of delegates in a day is up for grabs, including in Colorado. A two-sentence provision in Section 3 of the 14th Amendment states that anyone who swore an oath to uphold the Constitution and then engaged in insurrection against it is no longer eligible for state or federal office. After Congress passed an amnesty for most of the former Confederates, the measure targeted in 1872, the provision fell into disuse until dozens of suits were filed to keep Trump off the ballot this year. Only the one in Colorado was successful. Trump is separately appealing to state court a ruling by Maine's Democratic Secretary of State, Sheenad Bellows, that he is ineligible to appear on that state's ballot over his role in the Capitol attack. Both the Colorado Supreme Court and the Maine Secretary of State's rulings are on hold until the appeals play out. CCA, Aurora Police Honor Community, Student Inclusion Leaders. Students won scholarships and community leaders were honored and awarded for their work and dedication in diverse communities during an MLK celebration this week. Community College of Aurora held a luncheon January 24th honoring Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., part of a month-long series of MLK Jr. events across the city. Dozens were in attendance. Nine students who were active in their communities, embracing and celebrating diversity and empowering others, were each awarded a $500 scholarship. Not all scholarship winners attended the luncheon. Those students were William Isaac Owens III for his work, a culinary arts nonprofit that works with the unhoused community. Chantella M. Young, a first-generation graduate. Her goal is to get a director's certificate in early childhood development and graduate at the top of the dean's list. She also wants to open her own daycare. Abenish Baricha, who is in her last semester at the community college and plans on getting a bachelor's and master's degree in social work so she can change the system that we are all trying to survive through. Helen Gourmet, who tutors others in a local literacy program and works with adult learners. Daphne Perez, a Chicani mechanical engineer student. She aspires to contribute to space or sea exploration. Teresa de Jesus Orienta, a single mom of two daughters and a part-time student. She is currently working towards a certificate as a medical translator and interpreter. Her goal is to help her community by getting them more involved in other programs. Akelia Reddy, who is in her second semester at the community college. She is pursuing an associate's degree of arts and plans to transfer to Metro State University, Denver, to major in environmental science with a minor in microbiology. Van Hoa Dung, who is currently in her second year at the community college and plans to transfer to a four-year university to study electrical engineering in the future. Alyssa Williams, a first-generation African-American who is in the college's integrated nursing program. Her goal is to become a nurse and work with at-risk women and children. The Aurora Police Department presented the Everyday Hero Awards. The awards were given to several Aurora community members for their unwavering commitment to our community has led to significant and positive engagements with the Aurora Police Department. The following people won the award. Adriana Laurie, for her rich history of working with populations traditionally resistant to engagement, focusing on improving access to education, resources, and equity. Charicia Miller, for role in advancing civil rights and community service, due to her roles as a regional secretary for the NAACP, an advisor for the Aurora Youth Council, and the City of Aurora Martin Luther King Jr. Commission. Mateos Alvarez works as the executive director of the Aurora Economic Opportunity Coalition. APD applauded his work connecting APD with the immigrant and refugee communities and fostering meaningful connections. Chance Horichie, for her pivotal role in enhancing cooperation between APD and the local business community, and for being at the front of promoting a spirit of celebration and inclusion. APD also honored Sergeant Bill Hummel, Officers Abdul Sayadi, Tien Nguyen, Darian Hunt, Francisco Sarducio for their work with the community. Bo Green, Director of Student Advocacy and recipient of last year's Spirit of the King Award, presented this year's winners. The Spirit of the King Award is presented to the community college staff, faculty of student population, who has been an ally or advocate for themselves and others and contributed to creating more inclusive and equitable environments on campus and or in the community. This year's winners were Dr. Bita Beforez, Lily Late, Jada Gray. The CCA Foundation was also awarded the inaugural Community Impact Award. They were honored for their dedicated work towards education, advocacy, and the CCA student community has resulted in the affordability and accessibility of college. Aurora's new interim police chief, Heather Morris, says she'll focus on outreach to cops and public. By Max Levy, Sentinel, Colorado staff writer. Heather Morris outlined her plans for strengthening ties between the Aurora Police Chief's office and the rest of the police department and city this week, saying one of her top priorities as chief will be building trust through outreach. I think communication is really important because in the absence of communication, it's a vacuum. There's a hole. And so we start making things up. It's just what we do if we don't know what's going on, the city's latest interim chief of police said January 23rd during her first interview with the Sentinel. This is really a great community, and I've really enjoyed getting out and meeting a lot of people, and I'm going to continue to do that. Morris is the fourth person in 2 years to hold the reins of the Aurora Police Department. After Vanessa Wilson's firing in April 2022, the department was led for several months by Dan Oates, who had served as Aurora's chief a decade prior at the time of the Century 16 movie theater shooting. The city of Aurora launched a nationwide search for Wilson's replacement but came up empty-handed toward the end of Oates' employment contract. Before his departure, Oates was able to entice another experienced chief to Aurora, Art Acevedo, who previously led police departments in Miami, Houston, and Austin. Acevedo served as chief for 13 months, but never shed the interim title. On January 16th, he announced publicly that he would step down and return to Texas to spend time with his teenage son. As of January 22nd, the mantle passed to Morris, who worked with Acevedo in Houston and Miami before Acevedo invited her to serve as Aurora's interim deputy chief last year. Like his predecessors, Acevedo left controversy in his wake. He sniped at police union representatives at a press conference shortly before announcing his resignation. And the city of Aurora has released surveillance camera footage of a heated courthouse argument that happened the following day, where Acevedo appeared to poke the chest of a city attorney as members of the public looked on. Acevedo later said pressure from the city's police unions, Fraternal Order of Police Lodge 49, and the Aurora Police Association did not influence his decision to step down. The unions rallied opposition to Wilson in the months before her departure, organizing a no-confidence vote in October 2021. While Acevedo has not commented on the poking incident, city manager Jason Batchelor has said it didn't factor into the chief's leaving. Morris was standing next to Acevedo and Pete Schlute of the city attorney's office during the incident, but brushed it off as nothing unusual for the two men, who she described as having big personalities. Had there been an attack, I wouldn't have been just standing there, she said. Anything that was inappropriate in terms of physical contact, I certainly would have intervened. She declined to say what the two were arguing about, describing the subject matter as attorney-client privileged. Morris also said her vision for opening lines of communication between her office and rank-and-file officers will involve sitting down and finding common ground with representatives of the department's two unions. Her comments stood in contrast to the adversarial rhetoric that Acevedo used shortly before leaving the department. During a January 11th press conference, the former chief said that, "If you listen to the union rep, no officer has ever done anything wrong." He also said he did not care what the union thinks, adding that, "She doesn't care what the union thinks," in reference to Morris. "The chief doesn't speak for me," Morris said this week. "I speak for myself." When asked whether she felt the need to reconcile with the unions after Acevedo's comments, Morris said her concern was probably not so much about reconciliation, but rather moving forward. "It's based on sharing information and having conversations," Morris said. "It's not about me, and it's not about them. It's about the men and women of this department. So, I'm going to do everything I can to establish a good relationship and good communication with both the FOP and the APA. She said she plans to start sharing weekly messages from the chief's office and regularly attend roll calls and briefings to form a deeper connection with officers. Morris also hopes to build on the progress the department made under Acevedo toward fighting officer shortages through recruitment. As of Tuesday, the department deployed 630 officers, with another 57 officers completing academy training in two classes, out of a budgeted sworn staff of 748. The total number of officers in the academy is the largest the department has seen in years, which Morris credited to changes to the department's hiring process that were designed to streamline recruitment and meet the requirements of the city's consent decree reform agreement with the Colorado Attorney General's office. "We didn't do this alone," Morris said, acknowledging the city's Human Resources Department and the authors of the decree. "We now have the resources to be able to get folks through much quicker and offer up jobs." The department hopes to bring a cadet program online this year in partnership with the Community College of Aurora, which Morris said could serve as a bridge for high school students involved in the APD Explorers program and other young people interested in law enforcement careers to find jobs in the department. Morris said the department will also prepare a strategic plan for retaining officers, incorporating input from her command staff, union leaders, and officers themselves. While the department has struggled to meet some of the goals included in the consent decree, specifically concerning the management of use of force data, which the firm tasked with monitoring Aurora's progress has described as extremely concerning, Morris said the department is close to publishing its online transparency portal. The webpage will make current APD enforcement data available to the public. Morris said the first phase of the rollout will include use of force data, with a second phase including information about bias-motivated crimes. She said the department's anti-bias training for officers, for which the consent decree set a deadline of February 2022, will be unveiled in the next couple of months. Morris also said she wants to continue to promote proactive policing efforts, such as the department's direct action response teams and other special units designed to combat gangs and gun violence. Acevedo previously credited a recent local drop in crime to Aurora's pursuit of proactive policing as well as municipal mandatory minimum sentencing laws, even as the state and other large cities experienced similar drops. When asked whether she would consider sticking around to become the first permanent chief since Wilson's firing, Morris said she was open to the idea. "If, when we've done all these things, the men and women of the department and the city and the community want me to remain here as the chief of police, it would be a privilege," she said. "I'm proud to wear this uniform. I've worn the Houston Police Department and Miami Police Department uniforms, and I'm just as proud to wear the Aurora Police Department uniform." Lauren Boebert mounts defense to criticisms of carpetbagging in packed First Republican debate. By Jesse Badian, Associated Press. Fort Lupton. Republican primary candidate Mike Lynch didn't sugarcoat the question to his opponent on the Cram debate stage. Republican Representative Lauren Boebert, who hopped into the race last month partly over fear of a loss in the district she currently represents. "Could you give me a definition of carpetbagger?" Lynch asked to low murmurs from the crowd at the first Republican primary debate in Fort Lupton, a community in Colorado's 4th District. It was expected. The candidate before Lynch had asked the same question, if more delicately put. The accusation had already been lobbed at Boebert after she joined the packed primary race, escaping a rematch against Democrat Adam Fritsch, who nearly beat her in the last election. With Republicans hanging on to control of the U.S. House by their fingertips, Republicans and Democrats are wrestling fiercely over every close race. That includes the seat Boebert holds in Colorado's 3rd District, which was considered solidly leaning to the GOP but changed to a toss-up for this year after Boebert won by only 546 votes in 2022. The updated assessment partly prompted her flight to the new district and the criticism that followed. On stage, Boebert didn't hesitate in response to the attack. "The crops may be different in Colorado's 4th District, but the values are not. And I am a proven fighter for the values that you all believe in," said Boebert, her voice forcefully over the wide room in a recreation center. The crowd, a who's who of local Republicans and voters, sat around tables where red popped among dark suits, including red solo cups and Boebert's signature lipstick. Boebert built herself into a household name with a style of pugilistic politics that has turned otherwise tame moments in Congress into slugfests. Along with hardliner conservative stances and unwavering loyalty to former President Donald Trump. While Colorado's congressional representatives do not have to live in the district they represent, only the state, Boebert is moving to Weld County in her new district, jokingly described by the moderator as the most heavily Republican seat on the planet Earth. The corner of the Great Plains is a sweep of prairie grass and farms broken only by ranching towns where auctioneers chant the weight and price of cattle near every week. Voters supported Trump by nearly 20% points in 2020, more than double the margin in Boebert's old district. Jerry Sonnenberg, a popular former state senator with a tactically deployed baritone, was among the 6 of 9 candidates on stage who raised their hands when asked if they had been arrested, to raucous applause. Another, Rep. Richard Holtorf, the Republican whip in the Colorado House, has been most outspoken about Boebert's move. Deborah Flora, a filmmaker and radio host, was the first to levy her question of switching districts at Boebert on stage. State Rep. Lynch also exchanged barbs with Boebert. Lynch was Colorado's House Minority Leader until he stepped down Wednesday after a 2022 arrest for drunken driving came to light, an issue that was largely met with forgiveness by fellow contestants. Boebert was caught on video vaping and groping with a date in a Denver theater in September, but the embarrassing episode went unmentioned at the debate. Still, the scandal may be hard to shake in Boebert's new electoral stomping grounds, where voters hold tight to conservative Christian values some feel she transgressed. The Congresswoman must rely on her national name and convince skeptical voters that her voice is needed in Congress more than those of her homegrown opponents, some of whom have lived in the district their entire lives and represent parts of the area in Colorado's legislature. Boebert focused on her experience in Congress as the key factor separating her from the candidates on stage. "Everyone will talk like a Freedom Caucus member, but there is only one who governs as a Freedom Caucus member," she said. "I am here to earn your support, earn your vote. This is not a coronation." Boebert's primary rivals largely seemed hesitant to directly attack her on stage, which was reminiscent of the Republican presidential primary candidates who avoided criticism of Trump in earlier debates. The debate also largely centered on national political issues including border security, abortion, and fentanyl, on which Boebert could laud her stubbornly conservative voting record. Her opponents didn't raise local issues they may have thought she was unprepared to represent. Before switching districts, Boebert had been expected to face a rematch against Frisch, who had already raised more money than she had. Political experts generally agree Republicans have a better chance of holding on to the 3rd district without Boebert in the race. ADUs unfold as Centennial eyes land banking. Hoping to address concerns about the rising costs and high demand for housing in Centennial, the City Council is drafting potential regulations for accessory dwelling units. As part of that process, city officials are also researching a strategy called land banking. For more than a year, the council has been studying and discussing potential strategies to address housing affordability and accessibility issues in Centennial. One is permitting accessory dwelling units, or ADUs. These are smaller, secondary residential structures located behind a house or within a house, according to the city. Many people call them granny flats or mother-in-law apartments. The city is developing a rough draft of potential regulations for ADUs with city council input. At a January 9th meeting, city staff asked this council if it wanted occupancy limits for ADUs or an owner occupancy requirement, which refers to when homeowners are required to live in either the primary house or the ADU. The council decided against an occupancy limit or owner occupancy requirement, with several saying enforcement would be an issue. "I don't think that we have the staff power and manpower, really, to regulate it effectively," said council member Robin Carnes. Staff said the next step is to bring forward a roughly 90% to 100% complete draft of ADU regulations for the council's consideration. The city is also considering another strategy to address housing needs. It's called land banking. This is a tool local governments use to buy, acquire, and hold land for later development, such as affordable housing projects, according to a city report. The report said land banking is most effective in the following scenarios. The city can acquire and hold land to either donate or sell at a reduced price to an affordable housing project. The city can acquire or accept donated land to later sell at a higher price to help pay for affordable housing. A land trust could help pay for the rehabilitation of existing affordable housing. A lingering question, however, is what land in Centennial is suitable for affordable housing and land banking. According to a city staff report, Centennial does not have an extensive amount of city-owned land that could be used to jumpstart a land banking program. Determining potential land sites would help the city understand the potential costs for initial land acquisition and help the city become more competitive for grant applications, according to the report. Melanie Ward, a city staff member, asked the council if it supported staff conducting further research into land banking, to which the council agreed. According to the report, staff will compile an inventory of land within Centennial that may be appropriate for future affordable housing. "We would start with land that's currently vacant or undeveloped, as well as any land that's publicly owned," Ward said. "Maybe it's not owned by the city, but maybe it's owned by the county or a school district, and they're looking for our alternative uses for it." Staff will also look into some privately owned property, such as religious institutions that are considering additional uses for their land, as well as shopping centers that are transitioning, she said. The city will engage with affordable housing developers, organizations, and professionals to better understand and evaluate if affordable housing can be successful in certain areas, according to the staff report. The outcome of this work is expected to be a report showing feasible areas and potential sites and may include cost estimates for property acquisition and estimates of potential housing unit creation, the report said. Those interested in learning more about Centennial's housing study and policy development project can visit Centennial.co. Those interested in learning more about Centennial's housing study and policy development project can visit centennialco.gov/housing. Residents can share their input on the project and the strategies being considered by calling 303-754-3308 or emailing housing@centennialco.gov. Continued decline of stream flows projected for Colorado. Scientists predict with high confidence that Colorado's future spring runoff will come earlier. Soil moisture will be lower. Heat waves, droughts, and wildfires will be more frequent and intense. And a thirstier atmosphere will continue to rob rivers of their flows. Changes that are all driven by higher temperatures caused by humans burning fossil fuels. These findings are according to the third Climate Change in Colorado Assessment Report, produced by scientists at the Colorado Climate Center at Colorado State University. Commissioned by the Colorado Water Conservation Board, the report's findings have implications for the state's water managers. Borrowing a phrase from climate scientist Brad Udall, climate change is water change, which has become a common maxim for those water managers. The report focuses on 2050 as a planning horizon and projects what conditions will be like at that time. According to the report, by 2050, the statewide annual temperatures are projected to warm by 2.5 to 5.5 degrees Fahrenheit compared with a late 20th century baseline, and 1 to 4 degrees compared with today. Colorado temperatures have already risen by 2.3 degrees since 1980. By 2050, the average year is likely to be as warm as the hottest years on record through 2022. This warming, which scientists are very confident will come to pass, will drive the other water system changes that Colorado can expect to see. As temperatures rise and stream flows decline, water supply will decrease. According to the report, by 2050, there will be an annual reduction of 5 to 30% in stream flow volume, a 5 to 30% reduction of April 1st snow water equivalent, a measure of how much water is in the snowpack, and an 8 to 17% increase in evaporative demand, a measure of how thirsty the atmosphere is. A hotter, drier atmosphere can fuel dry soils and wildfire risk. Peak snowpack, which usually occurs in April, is also predicted to shift earlier by a few days to several weeks. Stream flows are primarily driven by snowpack that melts in the spring, said Becky Bollinger, CSU research scientist, assistant state climatologist, and lead author of the report. When you are warming your temperatures, you are first changing the timing of when that snowpack will melt. And because we're losing more to the atmosphere, that means we have less to run off in our rivers and be available for us later. Scientists are less certain about whether precipitation will increase or decrease in the future. Dry conditions have persisted across the state over the past two decades, with four of the five driest years occurring since 2000. Most climate models project an increase in winter precipitation, but they suggest the potential for large decreases in summer precipitation. But even if precipitation stays the same, stream flows will dwindle because of increased temperatures. CWCB officials hope water managers across the state will use the report to help plan for a future with less water. Many entities have already shifted to developing programs that support climate adaptation and resilience. I think we can say with confidence that it is more likely that we will have water shortages in the future, said Emily Adid, CWCB Senior Climate Adaptation Specialist. I think this report is evidence of that and can help local planners and people on the ground plan for those reductions in stream flow. Denver Water is one of those water providers that will use the report's finding in its planning. The utility, which is the oldest and largest in the state, provides water to 1.5 million people and helped to fund the report. Denver Water has been preparing for a future with less reliable water supply through conservation and efficient measures, reservoir expansion projects, and wildlife mitigation. Projected future stream flows is a huge challenge for the water resource industry, said Taylor Winchell, Denver Water's senior planner and climate adaptation specialist. The same amount of precipitation in the future means less stream flow because temperatures will continue to warm. All this leads to this concept of uncertainty. We really need to plan for a variety of ways the future can happen, essentially. Another finding of the report is that temperatures have warmed more in the fall than other seasons, with a 3.1 degrees Fahrenheit increase statewide since 1980, a trend that is expected to continue. Although it's hard to pinpoint the exact cause of fall warming, Bollinger said it may have to do with the summer monsoons pattern, which can bring moisture with near-daily thunderstorms, but which have been weaker in recent years. That precipitation is critical, she said. First, you're keeping the temperatures from getting too hot because you're clouding over and getting storms, Bollinger said. And generally, with higher humidity, you're going to have less evaporative loss from the soil. What we've been seeing in recent years is that we're not getting that moisture in the late summer and into the fall. Less moisture and higher temperatures in the fall also leads to lower soil moisture and kicks off a vicious cycle of decreased water supplies. The dry soil gets locked in under the winter snowpack, and when spring melting begins, the water must replenish the soils before feeding rivers and streams. That is what occurred in the Upper Colorado River Basin in 2021, when a near-normal snowpack translated to just 31% of normal runoff and the second-worst inflow ever into Lake Powell. Some water use sectors already experience shortages, especially those with junior water rights. Initiatives set up to support the environment and recreation are also at risk with shortages. And those shortages are likely to get worse in the future. In addition to grant programs, one of the ways CWCB aims to help these water users adapt with a future avoid cost explorer, and those shortages are likely to get worse in the future. In addition to grant programs, one of the ways CWCB aims to help these water users adapt with a future avoided cost explorer, FACE tool, which is outlined in the 2023 water plan. This modeling tool can help water managers figure out the cost of addressing, or failing to address, hazards such as wildfires, droughts, and floods. According to the report, extreme climate-driven events such as heat waves, droughts, and wildfires are expected to be more frequent and intense. That gives you a little bit of perspective to say, well, what if I invest to migrate this now? How can I lessen the potential impact in the future? Said Russ Sands, chief of CWCB's Water Supply Planning Section. I'm not trying to scare people. What we're trying to do is motivate change and help them invest early. Despite the near certainty of continued warming and resulting changes to the water system, Bollinger said there is a bright spot. Since the last time that a climate change in Colorado report was issued in 2014, the world has begun to take action on reducing fossil fuel use and has shifted away from the worst-case scenario. Earlier projections were based on a business-as-usual assumption with no climate mitigation. We do have things that have been put into place internationally, like the Paris Accord, Bollinger said. We are more along the lines of a middle-case scenario. As long as we continue to take the actions that have been planned out, we are going to follow that middle scenario, which does snow warming, but it's not as bad. Award surprises Graceful Cafe owner by Nina Joss. As she chatted with community members during a seemingly regular day of work at Graceful Community Cafe, founder Heather Greenwood was approached by a stranger holding a giant check. "I'm looking for Heather," the stranger said. Greenwood turned around, confused. The next moment, the stranger delivered a piece of news that would soon bring Greenwood to tears of surprise and joy. This past year, we've been seeking nominations for people who have positively impacted community across Colorado, the stranger told Greenwood. Your friend, Tammy, nominated you for our Community Advocate Award, and you won. The room burst into applause as Greenwood accepted a $15,000 check, honoring her commitment, advocacy, and support of the Littleton community through her Pay What You Can Cafe. Greenwood is one of four award recipients across the state being recognized by Ant Credit Union, a Colorado Springs-based financial company, with its Community Advocate Awards for 2023. The credit union started its Community Advocate Award program to honor the two men who saved lives by confronting the Club Q shooter in November 2022. After its inaugural year, the credit union decided to continue the award to honor individuals who transform lives and foster unity in their communities. Greenwood does this work at Graceful Community Cafe, which she founded with her husband in 2016 to provide accessible meals and a gathering space. I grew up on a farm in Nebraska, and that was just life as I knew it. Community taking care of each other. And the way that we did that often was through food, Greenwood said. I just got involved in food ministry along the way and realized I love building relationships across the table. If a person pays less than the full price of a meal, the Graceful Foundation, a nonprofit connected to the cafe, will pick up the difference. Visitors who pay more than the cost of their meal will help fund meals for others. The cafe serves people from all backgrounds, aiming to make an especially accessible restaurant for those who may not normally be able to afford to go out and eat, said Tammy Slifer, executive director of the foundation. We serve people with love and dignity, she said. Whether it's a senior adult, whether it's somebody who's on disability, someone who's unemployed, somebody who's unhoused, maybe someone who's low income, living in a motel. In addition to supporting the cafe, the Graceful Foundation lobbies for policy change related to food insecurity at the state level, especially for those who are unhoused, Slifer said. Slifer said she nominated Greenwood for the award because of her steadfast commitment to supporting the community, especially through the organization's recent financial challenges. When the foundation and cafe entered 2023, Slifer said, it had a pretty significant negative budget. They told their community that they would have to close the cafe's doors unless they received a financial response. The cafe serves about $1,100 in free meals each day, Slifer said, and costs and the amount of need have risen in recent years. When the community heard this news, they responded. Slifer said the cafe and foundation received grants from Advent Health Littleton, a Nebraska-based family foundation called the Ryan Foundation, and a local family foundation that asked not to be named. In addition, the group gained new monthly donors and received an outpouring of support in year-end gifts, Greenwood said. Graceful Cafe received about $100,000 through its Gather, Eat, Give fundraiser and almost $60,000 during a statewide donation drive called Colorado Gives. On top of overcoming financial hurdles, Greenwood decided to hire Slifer to help lead the foundation in 2023. Heather works every hour of every day, managing both the cafe operations and the foundation, Slifer said. To think to close that down, what a great loss that would have been, not only to the community, but personally to her. I just felt like she's had to go through a lot of bravery this year. Greenwood said she was humbled to receive the award, and she couldn't have done it without her community. We felt so incredibly supported as we've made our home here in Littleton, she said. None of this work would be possible without our community and our amazing team and every guest that walks in the door and everyone that supports us, from our volunteers to city government to law enforcement. Slifer said the cafe is a special place in the community where everyone is welcome. Everyone is together at the table, she said. It doesn't matter your socioeconomic condition, race, religion, politics. This is just a great community cornerstone. And not only can you come here to have a great meal and a great conversation with anybody, but you can come here to give back and volunteer and know that it's meeting the needs in our community. More information on how to donate and volunteer is available at GracefulCafe.com. Suspected Centennial Walmart carjacker arrested, accused of attempted homicide. A man who allegedly pointed a gun at a woman and then stole her car in a Walmart parking lot in Centennial earlier this month has been arrested. The Arapahoe County Sheriff's Office named 25-year-old Pablo Vidal's Basalias as the suspect. On January 2nd, he allegedly pointed a gun at a woman in a Walmart parking lot on Briarwood Avenue, forcing her from her car and then drove away in it. An armed customer with a concealed weapons permit fired two rounds at the vehicle, striking the passenger door of the victim's car, according to the sheriff's office. Vidal Spesalius was arrested by the Denver Police Department on January 17th on what appears to be charges of unlawful possession of a controlled substance and a parole violation. The charges of listed offenses are on Denver's website. The Arapahoe County Sheriff's Office said on January 25th that an arrest warrant for Vidal Spesalius was issued for attempted homicide and aggravated auto theft in the Centennial case. Ginger Delgado, a public information officer for the sheriff's office, said via email that when the arrest warrant was issued, Vidal Spesalius was already in the Denver jail. The sheriff's office expects that Vidal Spesalius will be transferred to the Arapahoe County Detention Facility, and his bond was set at $250,000. Asked why investigators believe Vidal Spesalius is the Walmart carjacking suspect, the sheriff's office declined to answer, citing the active nature of their investigation. On January 3rd, the sheriff's office asked the public for help identifying a woman who allegedly got into the passenger seat of the stolen car with a suspect immediately after the carjacking. Delgado said the woman was identified but not charged with a crime. The stolen vehicle was located and returned to its owner, Delgado said. Pedestrian bridge at Ilati Street on Highline Canal Trail opens. Closed since October, a portion of the Highline Canal Trail in Littleton has opened with a new pedestrian bridge. The work replaced the old bridge over the canal at Ilati Street as part of a plan to update and improve the 71-mile-long canal trail. The bridge creates a wider path for pedestrians and cyclists who want to enter the trail from the preserve at South Bridge neighborhood, which is located just south of the trail. The project was a partnership between the Highline Canal Conservancy and South Suburban Park and Recreation District. The original pedestrian bridge was built, I believe, in around 1983 or 84, said Joe Ordworthlosky, a senior park planner with South Suburban. While the condition wasn't really particularly bad, it was just not wide enough to provide good accessibility. He said the original bridge was about 4 feet wide, which made it challenging for some people to enter the nature area. I spoke with a neighbor there, and they said that when they took their bikes down to the Highline Canal Trail, they had to walk their bikes because there was no way they could ride them, he said. The bridge was so skinny. The new bridge is 8 feet wide and 50 feet long, Ordworthlosky said. It is made of a type of steel with a natural rust finish and has a concrete deck. In addition to making it safer and more accessible to enter the trail, Ordworthlosky said the wider bridge will be easier to plow for snow and maintain. Susanna Jones, Senior Director of Programs and Partnerships at the Highline Canal Conservancy, said the bridge replacement is not the only improvement happening in the area. Within a mile of the bridge, the Conservancy and the Parks District are adding amenities at the junction of the Highline Canal Trail and the Lee Gulch Trail. She said there will be additional seating, a rock scramble area for kids to play on, and informational signage. The area boasts the Lee Gulch Flume, which is a significant historic resource as one of the three wooden flumes remaining on the canal, according to the Conservancy's website. A flume is a raised channel for water. In this case, it was built to transport the canal's water over the Lee Gulch. The canal itself was built as an irrigation ditch, Jones said. The canal water crosses numerous natural waterways, and so in order to cross those waterways, the canal water either has to go over it or has to go under. The signage at the Lee Gulch area will include information about the history of the flume, as well as education about the flora and fauna of the canal. The water cycle and the importance of water in the West, Jones said. Ode Roloski said crews will also create a concrete area where the Lee Gulch Trail and the Highline Canal Trail intersect to improve accessibility and safety. The project, including the pedestrian bridge and the other amenities, cost about $775,000 total, Jones said. This number does not include the costs of design, engineering, and outreach efforts, she said. South Suburban Park and Recreation District contributed about $265,000 to the project, and Arapaho County gave about $150,000, she said. The Highline Canal Conservancy contributed the rest in private dollars from fundraising, Jones said. Since 2016, when the Conservancy started its official collaboration with local governments to plan for the future of the canal, this is the first major project for the Conservancy is funded, she added. With community engagement shaping the project, Jones said she is excited to see the community's dollars, both public and private, going towards its own ideas. It's really exciting to see it come to life, directly from the community members' ideas and priorities for the trail, she said. For us, too, it's one of the first times we're really getting to celebrate the history of the canal through the educational, interpretive signage and elements that will be in this area. Now that the bridge is complete, Ode Roloski said construction on the Lee Gulch amenities will likely begin in the late spring. This portion of the project will cause trail closures at a section of the Lee Gulch Trail and the Highline Canal Trail. He said the district hopes for construction to be completed by midsummer. Trail users can get up-to-date information about trail statuses at https://highlinecanal.org/trail-notices- and https://gameplan.sspr.d.org/. New Littleton Shop aims to build a community around books. Stacked on shelves and laid on tables, books fill a small store on Littleton's main street. A candle flickers in the corner of the room, and the walls are decorated with quirky wallpaper, distinguishing the kids' area. Whimsical forest creatures from the main room, repeating black and white stars. Friends Corey Dahl and Amanda Boulding now opened Spell Books just over a month ago with a shared vision for the store. The goal was to be like a grandma's house, if grandma might be a witch, Dahl said with a smile. Nestled around an abundance of books are shelves of tarot card decks, candles, and journals. Through their new store, Dahl and Boldinow said they hope to reinvigorate a social spirit of reading in the Littleton community. Our idea behind this is not just to be a store where you buy a book, and then you go home and you read the book and you don't talk to anyone about the book, Dahl said. We want this to be a place where you can come and talk to a stranger and get recommendations from them. We want it to feel like you're browsing your best friend's bookcase. They said they want to create a space for connection, especially in a world where many seem to be lonely after the pandemic. When people buy books online, they don't usually interact with anyone during the process, Dahl said. She and Boldenow believe strengthening social connections around reading and writing can help fill the need for community. Boldenow said she and Dahl stock their merchandise based on books they have read and loved, books they want to read, or ones that have great reviews. As their business moves forward, they want to stock even more based on what customers are interested in. We're a small shop, and it is curated, but any book anyone wants, we can get for them, Dahl said. If they just want to support an independent bookstore without reading the books that we like, that's always possible. Dahl and Boldenow met during an intensive writing workshop in Denver about 10 years ago, where they became roommates and friends. The duo is also offering writing workshops at Spellbooks. One focuses on using tarot cards to spark inspiration. I think tarot reading is like telling a story and has a lot of similarities to writing and reading, Dahl said, adding that Spellbooks is not a metaphysical store, but she and Boldenow wanted to incorporate their interest in the space. They are also offering creative writing workshops for adults and kids, as well as a book club. More information about classes and events is available at https://www.spellbooksco.com/4-classes-events. Boldenow and Dahl, both residents of Littleton at points in their lives, said they have always felt that an independent bookstore would complete the downtown area. As a result, the personal fulfillment of bringing the shop to life has been significant. I think my favorite part is just knowing that I have found something that I want to do and be part of it until I'm too old to do it, Boldenow said. We're just surrounded by what we love again. On Monday, Spellbooks is closed for retail but open for tarot card readings by appointment. Thanks again for joining us for the Arapahoe County News. My name is Tim Elliott.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.